from 1985, Socks, Soaps, and the Joys of Being Woken from Sweet Slumber by a Dog with a Weak Bladder. Nicholas Barnes stars in the last of three talks given by Adrian Mole at Christmas.
I often look back on my callow youth, and when I do, a smile flits across my now mature but pitted face. I hardly recognise the naive boy I once was. To think that I once believed that Evelyn Waugh was a woman. Of course, now, with a couple of O-levels under my belt, I am far more sophisticated, and I know that Evelyn Waugh, should he be alive today, would be very, indeed dead proud of his daughter Auberon, because, of course, Evelyn is the father of Auberon, and not, as I once thought, the mother. I occasionally glance through my early diaries and mourn for my lost innocence, for at the age of 13 3/4, I thought it was sufficient to just have a life. I honestly didn't know then that you can't just have a life. You have to have a lifestyle. So, my talk today is about lifestyle, with particular reference to my own. For instance, the style of my dress is idiosyncratic. Indeed, it is personal to myself. Since radio is not television, I will describe what I am wearing at the moment. I will start at my head and work down to save any confusion. On my head, I am wearing a balaclava helmet knitted by my ancient yet nimble-fingered grandma. I am wearing the balaclava because my father refuses to switch the central heating on until October the 17th every year. He cares not that English summer does not exist anymore. As usual, he's being selfish and thinking about paying the boring gas bill. We move down. Around my neck is a silken cravat, which was formerly owned by my dead grandfather. It is a lucky cravat. My grandfather wore it at Epsom, and won half a crown on a horse. Whatever half a crown is. My shirt is proudly, indeed, unashamedly, from a CND rummage sale. It once belonged to a Canadian lumberjack who had a sweat, or, more politely, a perspiration problem. At least so my mother maintains. The smell doesn't bother me, as I am used to it, although other people have complained. Under the shirt, I wear an I Love Cliff Richard t-shirt, a reminder of when I was young and stupid. I never unbutton a Canadian shirt. My legs are clad in a pair of executive striped trousers bought at the closing down sale at Woolworths. On my feet are the designer training shoes given to me by my best friend Nigel. Under my training shoes, I am wearing a pair of odd socks. One sock is white, one sock is black. No, think not that I am an absent-minded genius who doesn't notice what he puts on his feet. Perhaps I am a genius, but not an absent-minded one. No, my choice of hosiery is completely calculated. Indeed, it is symbolic. The white sock stands for my inner purity and morality, for I am against violence and Polaris missiles and cruelty to battery hens. The black sock stands for the evil in my soul, such as wanting to go the whole hog with Pandora and fantasizing about blowing up tower blocks, minus suicidal tenants, of course. Thus, I am a walking dichotomy. On my feet, I carry the problems of the world. Naturally, the hoi polloi do not recognize this salient fact. They cry out, "Hey, you're wearing odd socks!" For adornments, i.e. jewellery around my neck, I am wearing a gold-plated chain and locket. In the locket are the remains of a dried-up autumn leaf. The leaf represents the frailty of the human condition. It was given to me by Pandora in a moment of autumnal passion. Round my left wrist, I wear a copper bangle, which hopefully will guard against me contracting arthritis in old age. On my right wrist, I wear a plastic waterproof watch, which will allow me, should I feel the need, to dive to a depth of 100 feet. I have one other personal adornment that nobody knows about apart from me and one other person. It is a tiny tattoo secreted in a private part of my body. The tattoo says, Mum and Dad, and dates from a time of their marital instability. I now regret my impetuosity, because this tattoo will prevent me from partaking in nude sunbathing in the years to come. So, when I am a poet millionaire, and I am lying on my very own Greek island, I will be the only person amongst my guests to be wearing trunks. However, the Greek island home is for the future. My present domestic abode is a semi-detached house in a suburban cul-de-sac in the Midlands. The warm scent of home baking does not fill our house, so I create my own smell by baking scones. Here is my recipe, but remember, before you rush for pencil and paper, that the recipe is copyright and owned by me, Adrian Mole. So, should you wish to bake scones to this recipe, then you will need to send money to me. Please don't send scones. The GPO is not noted for its gentle handling of soft matter. Right, pencils ready? Here goes. Ingredients for A. Mole scones. 4 ounces of flour, or metric equivalent. 2 ounces of butter, or metric equivalent. 2 ounces of sugar, or metric equivalent. 1 egg. Eggs are still only eggs. Method. Beat up all ingredients. Make a tin greasy, bung it all in. Turn oven to number 5. Wait until scones are higher than they were. Should be 12 minutes, but keep opening oven door every 30 seconds to check. Got it? Good luck. Crunching on my fresh-from-the-oven scones, I wind down from my day. Let me tell you how I wind up to it. The dog usually wakes me up at 7 o'clock or thereabouts. It's dead old now and has a weak bladder. I get out of bed, and in my underpants and vest, I open the back door and let it out to cock its leg on our next-door neighbor's lawn. I have a baby sister now, and she usually climbs out of her cot at 7:30, dragging her wet nappy with her. She barges into my room and gabbles some childish gibberish, to which I respond curtly. I say, "Go and wake Mummy and Daddy up, Rosemary." I refuse to bastardize her name and call her Rosie. She staggers out on her wobbly legs and beats her tiny fists on my parents' door. Muffled curses tell me that my parents are awake, so I quickly get out of bed and run into the bathroom before anyone else. I lay in my bath and ignore rattlings on the door and demands for entry. I insist on a period of quiet before I start my day. Anyway, it's not my fault that the only lavatory is placed in the bathroom, is it? I've lost track of the times I've told my father to install a downstairs lavatory. After completing a meticulous toilet, I emerge from the bathroom, have a row with my parents standing cross-legged outside the door, and go down to breakfast. My parents are victims of Thatcherism, so neither of them is working, which means they are able to hang about and linger over their breakfasts. I go to my room, collect my books and study aids, and go to work. I ignore most of my fellow students, who are usually thronging the corridors, laughing about the previous night's drunken debauch. Instead, I make my way to a classroom and quietly study before the lessons begin. I spend each break with Pandora. We usually talk about world events. Pandora only wears black clothes, as she is in mourning for the world. This has led to her being called Barmy Braithwaite by unthinking morons among the student body, and also, I regret to report, some of the academic staff. We usually walk home together, and on the way call in to see Bert Baxter, who is now the oldest man on the electoral roll. Pandora takes Sabre the Alsatian for an angry prowl round the recreation ground, while I clean Bert up and listen to his incoherent ramblings about Lenin and the needs of the proletariat to rise up. Bert refuses to die until he sees the fall of capitalism. So it looks as though Bert will be with us for quite a while yet, unfortunately. When Bert and Sabre have been pacified, fed and watered, Pandora and I walk home together. We part at the entrance to my cul-de-sac, and she strolls off to her tree-lined avenue and her detached book-lined house, and I go to my previously described more horrible domestic living unit. Once there, I may give Rosemary a few minutes' attention. Last night I built the GPO tower for her in Lego bricks, but while my back was turned, Rosemary smashed it to pieces, and then had the nerve to laugh amongst the rubble. This is typical of her behaviour. I have urged my parents to take her to the child guidance clinic before it's too late. But my mother defends her, saying, "Rosie is quite normal, Adrian. All toddlers behave like Attila the Hun. Why do you think so many mothers are on tranquilizers?" In the early evening, I make a point of watching a soap opera or two. I think it's very important for us intellectuals to keep in touch with popular culture. We cannot live in ivory towers, unless, of course, the ivory towers have a television aerial on the roof. My parents are trying to save their marriage by playing badminton together on alternate Wednesdays. Otherwise, apart from this fortnightly outing, they clutter the house up in the evenings, so I am forced to keep to my room or take to the streets. I make few demands on them. All I require is a jar of multivitamins once a week, plus clean linen and courtesy. However, I wouldn't like you to switch off thinking that I'm not fond of my parents. In my own way, I'm very close to them. It's hard not to be. We live in a small house, and they do have their good points. My father is quite a wit after a couple of glasses of vodka, and my mother is known for her compassion towards other married women. In fact, she is in the middle of organizing a local group of them. I read somewhere that it is important for families to have bodily contact, so I make a point of patting my parents' shoulders as I pass by. It costs me nothing, and it seems to please them. However, at 8 o'clock, when the lounge is full of cigarette smoke, I make my excuses and leave for the outside world. I sometimes meet up with Barry Kent, and we chat about which of his friends is in court and who's who in Borstal. Occasionally we discuss Barry's poetry. He was taught to read and write during his last period in a detention centre. It was a progressive place that had a poet in residence, so instead of breaking rocks, Barry was forced to split infinitives and then put them together again. Some of his stuff is quite good. Primitive, of course, but then Barry is practically a certified moron, so it's only to be expected. Still, at least he's making a living out of his poetry. In the guise of Baz, the skinhead poet, he tours pubs and rock venues and shouts poetry at the audience. Sometimes they shout back, and then there's a fight. Barry always wins. On my way home, I call in to see Pandora, who's usually sitting under the angle-poise lamp, bent over A-level homework. We share a cup of cocoa, or, if her parents are out, a gin and tonic. Then we kiss passionately for about 5 minutes, longer if it's a gin night, and I make my way home, racked with latent sexuality. By 11 o'clock, I'm in bed with the dog reading, with a digestive biscuit and a cup of cocoa on my bedside table. It isn't the lifestyle I would choose for myself, but at least I've got a lifestyle. Some people haven't, and I'm on the verge, the very curb of the dual carriageway of fate. Will I go one way towards London, celebrity and media attention, or will I go the other way towards the provinces and be forced to write letters to the local paper in order to see my name in print? A third possibility occurs to me. I could break down at a crossroads and remain unsung in limbo. Knowing me, that'd be just my luck.
In the last of those three talks by Adrian Mole at Christmas, you heard Nicholas Barnes. The producer was John Tideman, and the writer was, of course, Sue Townsend.